Here's a summer travel tip. Pack just one pair of shoes that goes with every outfit and occasion, like the versatile, perfectly packable tree shoes from Allbirds. Made to look great and feel even better, they're the ideal choice for vacations, staycations, and every road trip in between. For an everyday, go-anywhere breathable sneaker, snag a pair of tree runners. If sporty's your style, you'll love the responsive foam and extra grip of the tree dashers too. And of course, you can't go wrong with the classic low-top look of the tree pipers. The best part is, they're all crafted with lightweight, breathable eucalyptus fiber that takes comfy to the next level. So you'll be stepping out in style and comfort wherever you go. Your summer adventures are just getting started, so you need shoes that can handle anything. That's why Allbirds has you covered. Step into summer travel with the perfect travel shoes from Allbirds. Find your pair of tree dashers, runners, pipers, and more at allbirds.com. That's allbirds.com.
You guys, I have said it once and I will say it again. 2024 is the year of health for me, and that includes making sure I stay hydrated. So, whether you hydrate to live, or if you live to hydrate, Liquid IV quenches your thirst faster than water alone with 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness, all in one single sugar-free stick. Sometimes drinking regular water over and over again, it just gets to be boring, but Liquid IV makes staying hydrated a more fun and enjoyable experience. Personally, for me, I look forward to drinking my favorite flavor, which is green grape, by the way, every single day, because not only is the flavor amazing, but it does the perfect job of quenching my thirst with the crisp taste. So whether I take Liquid IV after a long night out or after my workout, I'm certain that I will always feel hydrated and satisfied. With Liquid IV, there are no artificial sweeteners and there is zero sugar, which is really important for me. It's non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy, and one stick plus 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than just water alone. So however you hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code KILLER at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code KILLER at liquidiv.com. Hello everyone, what is up? Welcome back to another episode of Killer Instinct, you guys. Thank you so much for joining me here today. If you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah and I'm your host of Killer Instinct. Before we get started, make sure you go ahead and hit that subscribe button, that way you never miss an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday. We also post the video version onto YouTube on Wednesdays as well, so make sure you are subscribed. Now, if you've been keeping up for the past couple weeks, you would know that April's true crime category is serial killers. This was a category that you guys had heavily requested, and I am so excited that we're able to do it for April. And as you guys can tell by the title of today's episode, today we are talking about Sean Vincent Gillis. I'm not going to say too much because I don't want to give anything away, so let's just jump right on into it today. So this case really starts on January 5th, 1999 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. On that day, at approximately 4:45 a.m., 911 operators received a phone call from 2 hunters that claimed that they had stumbled across a dead body located in a newly built neighborhood. Now, immediately, police drove over to the area, and the newly constructed neighborhood was very, very secluded. There were only a couple houses that had been built. Now, when police arrived to the scene, they pulled up to the very end of the road, where they discovered the body laying on the ground at the end of the back roads. Now, the woman almost seemed posed with how she was laying. It seemed like her body had been laid out in a very bizarre manner. The way she was laying, she had one arm above her head and the other one by her side. One of her legs had been also laid out flat, and then the other one was bent. But besides the odd positioning of her body, the one thing that police noticed and what stood out to them the most is that the woman had appeared to be carved. This woman had been cut from head to toe. She had long cuts down her legs. She had been stabbed multiple times throughout her chest and torso. And along with that, her eyelids had also been removed and taken. Now, surprisingly to police, the one thing that they really did not see at the crime scene was an excess amount of blood. With the injuries that the woman had endured, it was without question that there was going to be severe blood loss. There should have been blood absolutely everywhere from this crime scene. However, there was none. And because of that, it really led police to believe two things. One, that this was probably not where this woman was killed. More so, it was a dumping site. And along with that, it also led police to believe that the cuts that were inflicted on the victim had been done post-mortem, so after the victim had been killed. Now, another reason that police believed that this was simply just a burial site rather than the place that the woman had been killed was because there was no evidence of anything in the surrounding areas. There was no evidence of a weapon. Like I said, there was no blood evidence. And along with that, there was nothing left at the scene. The woman did not have a purse. She did not have a wallet. She did not have an ID on her. And along with that, all of her clothes had been taken as well. Now, in terms of where the victim's body was found, like I said, it was found at the very end of a back road, and police had actually seen that where the victim was laying, it was right underneath a dead-end street sign. And with looking at this, police were trying to figure out if this was simply just coincidence or if this was their killer almost poking fun and taunting the police instead. Now, police began speaking to some of the people that worked in the neighborhood and were doing construction on the house to see if anyone had seen anything, if there was any witness who could give them any lead as far as who their suspect was. However, after speaking to multiple people, they really were left with no answers because no one saw a thing. Now, the victim was taken to the medical examiner to conduct an autopsy, and the medical examiner concluded that the cause of death was asphyxiation, and it had appeared that the woman had been strangled with an object. The victim had a very apparent ligature mark around her neck, and the medical examiner also found a piece of hair inside of the victim's mouth that was believed to be belonging to the killer. Now, we're talking about the time frame of 1999, and DNA testing was nowhere near as advanced as it is today, and because of that, police were not able to simply just run the piece of hair through a DNA system. What they had to do is they had to wait for police to bring forward a potential suspect, and then that way they would be able to confirm whether the potential suspect's piece of hair matched the piece of hair that was on their victim. Now, they were able to do some comprehensive testing on this piece of hair, and through that, they were able to figure out that the piece of hair did belong to a white male. Now, while they weren't really able to get much information about the killer, they were able to get information about their victim. They were able to take fingerprints and ran the fingerprints through the system and saw that their victim had been arrested for a minor arrest in the past, so the fingerprints were in the system, and she was identified as being 29-year-old Catherine Hall. Now, sadly, there really isn't much information out there about Catherine, and I looked high and low trying to locate any information that I could. As you guys know, I like to present you guys with information about the victims that we talk about to show who they were outside of the case itself. However, there really was none, unfortunately, in regards to Catherine. Now, the days after Catherine's body was discovered, police had received a phone call from crime scene investigators saying that they had found Catherine's ID out on an area called River Road. The ID was found in a jacket that was laying over the fence, and there was blood spatter on the fence. Now, they also discovered a large plastic zip tie in the area as well that police believe was used as the ligature to strangle Catherine. Now, that was really all of the information that police were able to initially gather in regards to Catherine's murder. They had no leads, and they really weren't making any progress in Catherine's case. The case really was at a standstill, so it eventually went cold for several years. So then fast forward several years later to October 11th, 2003, and this was approximately at 3:30 p.m. when 911 operators received a phone call from two teenage boys who claimed they discovered a body in the woods. Now, the body was found in the woods off of Port Hudson Road. And how this road was set up, just to give you a visual, was you could get off on the side of the road, but then there was a trail that took you back to the woods. So it wasn't like you got off on the side of the road and the woods were right there. It was you had to take a trail to get to where the woods were. And when police arrived, they were guided by these two boys back into the woods where they had discovered the body. Now, when police found the body, they noticed that it was very similar to Catherine. Some of those same detectives that were at Catherine's crime scene were also at this crime scene. So they immediately saw the similarities. They saw that, again, this victim was also posed in an odd fashion, and she also had those significant cuts down the backs of her legs. Now, unlike Catherine, this body had been dead for quite some time, and it was clear that it was in the early stages of decomposition. It was said that when police rolled the woman onto her back and she was face up, her face was very, very badly decomposed. However, it was clear that she did have that same ligature mark around her neck. Now, when they rolled her body over, they also realized that the woman's hands had been cut off right at the wrists. And again, similar to Catherine's murder, it was presumed that due to the lack of blood, the severing of the hands had been done post-mortem, and the location that she had been discovered at was not where she was murdered. Now, due to these similarities, police now started to believe that they are looking at the work of a serial killer. Now, during the autopsy of the second victim, the medical examiner confirmed that the removal of the victim's hands was done post-mortem. It was also confirmed that the cause of death was strangulation, which again matched up with those ligature marks on her neck. Now, there was another similarity to Catherine's murder as well, and that was that this time there was another piece of hair, and this piece of hair was found in the victim's wrist, her severed wrist. There was a piece of hair in them, and after processing that hair, it was confirmed that the hair from this victim and the hair found on Catherine was a match. So it was from the same person. But again, police still did not know who that person was. Now, shortly after the autopsy was performed, police received a phone call from a woman named Laura Williams, who said that she wanted to file a missing persons report for her mother, 45-year-old Johnny May Williams. Johnny May was born on November 16, 1957, in Louisiana to her parents, Richard and Octavia. She had two siblings, and when she got older, she settled down and married a man named Larry Williams, and the two had three children, Laura, Jenna, and Larry Jr. They lived in Sunshine, Louisiana, and after police spoke more with Laura about the physical description of her mother, they were able to confirm that their victim was in fact Johnny May Williams, and they were also able to make a positive identification through using Laura's DNA. Now, after talking more to Johnny May's friends and family, they learned that Johnny May lived a very high-risk lifestyle. She was known to have walked the streets of Baton Rouge late at night. She often engaged herself in different sex work, and because of that, she was involving herself in potentially very dangerous situations. And while they were learning a lot of new information about Johnny May that was indeed helpful to the investigation, it really didn't help police narrow anything down. So they were starting to get frustrated because they really had no leads here. They still didn't know who was doing this. They didn't know why they were doing this, and they didn't get any closer to finding any new leads. Then, several months later, on February 27th, 2004, there was another victim. Around 7 a.m., 911 operator received a phone call after a couple had been out looking for their lost dog, and instead they stumbled across a dead body. The body was laying on top of a brush pile off of the side of the road into a secluded area, and at first, the couple assumed that the body was a mannequin. However, upon closer look, they realized that it was, in fact, a dead body. Now, when police arrived to the scene, they discovered the body of a woman who had also suffered from severe post-mortem cuttings. Her left forearm had been cut off from her body. She had a ligature mark around her neck. She had her nipples removed, and there was also a 3x3, almost perfect square of flesh that had been removed from her thigh as well. Now, like I mentioned earlier, the body was discovered in a secluded area that had been nearby to a dam and a pond, so there had been some mud in the surrounding area, and when police were canvassing the crime scene, they did in fact find a tire track that was left in the mud nearby. Now, police could tell that the tire tracks were fresh, so they ended up taking an impression of the tire print and sent it off to the crime lab to get proper identification of the tire. Now, while that was happening, the body of the victim was then sent off to the medical examiner to perform an autopsy. Through the autopsy, the medical examiner was able to conclude that the cause of death was again asphyxiation based off of the ligature marks that were found around the victim's neck, and it was also clear what exactly was being used to strangle these victims, and that was a zip tie. It was believed that a very thick plastic zip tie was being used to strangle these women. And as I mentioned earlier in the case of Catherine Hall, when police were canvassing the crime scene, when they found her jacket and her ID, they also found that thick zip tie. Now, the medical examiner also found traces of DNA underneath the victim's fingernails, which had appeared to have been done in order to fight back her killer. And they were able to get that DNA from underneath the fingernails and compared it to the hair follicles that had been found on Johnny May and Catherine. And all of those were a match. So this was even further confirmation that all of these kills were being done by the same person. Now, the medical examiner was able to take the fingerprints of the victim and ran them through the APHIS system, which is the automated fingerprint identification system. And when doing that, she was able to narrow down who this victim was, which was Donna Bennett Johnston. Donna was born on July 6, 1960 to her parents, Joseph and Johnny May, and grew up with her two sisters and three brothers. Donna had five children. She had four sons and a daughter, and she was incredibly close to her kids. Her son Justin remembers the close-knit relationship that he had with his mom and how he was attached to Donna's hip growing up. He said that he remembered the day that Donna's body was recovered. He remembered that he was at school playing basketball and received a phone call from his dad telling him that he needed to come home because something was wrong. And ultimately, he learned that his mom had been murdered. Now, at this time, police started speaking to Donna's family and her friends to get a better understanding of who Donna was, and it was when doing this that police learned again that Donna did involve herself in a high-risk lifestyle, and that she had been recently hanging out with a man named Roy Purcell. So at this point, police went and spoke to Roy, really to get any information that they could, and when speaking to Roy, right off the bat, police learned that Roy was not necessarily going to be winning any Good Samaritan Award anytime soon. He did a lot of drugs. He sold a lot of drugs. He told police that he also involved himself in a lot of sex work with other women and would be with women who would trade their bodies for money. And so that was the picture that Roy was initially painting of himself to police. He also told police that he did know Donna and he knew her very well. And it was actually only 2 days before her murder when Roy claimed that he last saw Donna when she came over to his house. Now, while this questioning was going on, it was happening inside of Roy's home, and while Roy was being questioned by one detective, there was another detective who was looking around Roy's house and just kind of taking a glance of things, and Roy gave them permission to do this. Now, upon doing this, the detective that was walking around the home came across a purse that contained an ID in it, and the ID that was inside of the purse was for another unsolved murder victim, and that victim was named Christina Daigle. Now, Christina's body had been discovered across town. She had been found bound and gagged, and she had duct tape over her mouth. And when asked about this, Roy claimed that he also knew Christina. He was friends with Christina as well. Now, because of this, things aren't looking too great for Roy in this moment, because police are now looking at a man who is connected to two women who end up murdered, one being Donna and the other being Christina. Now, Roy adamantly denied that he had anything to do with either one of these murders, and police at this point aren't believing him. They believe wholeheartedly that they had found their killer, and they ask Roy to submit a DNA swab, which he voluntarily does. And at this point, it was a waiting game. Police brought back the DNA swab, sent it off to the forensics lab. However, it quickly came back to be a negative match to the other DNA samples that were found on all of the victims. So because of that, this told police that Roy was not their guy, and now they are back to square one. Now, at this point, police decided that they wanted to get the FBI involved in this case because they really needed help creating a profile for their killer in order to help narrow down who they were looking for here. Now, when the FBI got involved, the FBI made several observations. They said that whoever was doing this didn't necessarily care about the kill itself. That wasn't the exciting part for their killer. It was more so what happened after the kill. And that was very apparent because whoever this murderer was, he was spending a lot of time with his victims after he had killed them. The FBI believed that the severing of the limbs and the carving of the victims was purely for sexual gratification, and that that was the part that the killer looked forward to the most every single time. They said that all of these traits were in fact very rare. This was not something that police were used to seeing very frequently or something that they saw very often. However, at this point, they had a little bit better of an understanding of the type of guy that they were looking for. Now, I want to go back for a second and talk about the tire track impressions that we mentioned earlier. Now, police took those impressions to a local car dealer in Baton Rouge, and the detectives were able to get confirmation that the tire marks were in fact from a specific tire called AquaTread 3. Now, AquaTread 3 tires were a specific type of tire that came from the Goodyear Tire Company. And police spoke with Goodyear right after getting this information, and Goodyear was able to give police the list of dealerships in the area that carried that specific tire. So now police had this list of everywhere that carries these tires, and they went one by one to each of these dealerships that had the tires and were able to get a list of the customers that were purchasing the tires. Now, with this list, it was a very long list at first. However, police were able to narrow it down based off of the fact that they knew that they were looking for a white male. And they finally were able to narrow down this list to about 100 people. And once they had that list of 100 people, they then divided up the list to several different officers who all went and spoke to every single person on this list. They asked them questions, and they also obtained a DNA sample. Now, police had gone through almost everyone on this list, and there was no match to the DNA that they already had. But then there was one more name that was on this list, one more person that police needed to speak to, and that was a man named Sean Vincent Gillis. On April 28th, 2004, police went and spoke to Sean Gillis. Sean had purchased a set of the AquaTread tires, and when police arrived to his house, they saw that Sean's car was sitting in the driveway with those same exact tires still on it. Now, police knocked on the front door. However, they didn't get an answer, but they started hearing some noise coming from the backyard. At this point, they decided to make their way back there, and when they turned the corner, they saw Sean sitting in the chair in his backyard listening to the radio. Police said that when they arrived, Sean did not seem confused a single bit as to why they were there. Sean had told police that he was very aware about the ongoing investigation because he had been reading about it in the newspaper. And when police asked Sean if he had been to any of the crime scenes, Sean said yes. He claimed that he had in fact been to the field that Donna's body was discovered at several times before. So he had been there quite frequently. He was very much familiar with it. He claimed that it was his go-to spot to kind of go out, hang out, and decompress, smoke some weed, and that was where he would go. And initially, that was the only crime scene that Sean had confessed to ever being at. Now, police then asked Sean if he knew any of the victims, if he knew Donna or Johnny May or Catherine, and he said that he, in fact, did. He said that he was very good friends with Johnny Mae Williams. He claimed that him and Johnny were great friends. It started out as a relationship where Johnny would come over and clean his house, and then that turned into a friendship, which over time turned into a sexual relationship between Sean and Johnny Mae. Now, after having some conversation with Sean, police asked if he would be willing to submit a DNA swab, which Sean agreed to do. Now, the DNA swab was taken, and police then drove it over to the crime lab. Police also asked Sean at this time if he would be willing to come down to the police station and continue to answer a few more questions and just continue having conversation with them, and Sean agreed to do this. Now, once police and Sean had arrived to the station and the questioning began, the first real question that they had was in regards to Donna's crime scene. As I mentioned, Sean said that he had been there several times before, and police just wanted to know a little bit more information about when was the last time he had been there, why does he go out there, and according to Sean, he claimed that just several days before Donna's murder, he was out at that crime scene. He claimed that he had been out one night and he was drinking. He drove home and needed to use the bathroom, so he pulled over to the side of the road, which was that crime scene. He went to the bathroom, got back in his car, and drove home. So that is why and when Sean claimed that he was last at that crime scene. Now, according to police, they said that while talking to Sean was very much important and they were trying to get as much information out of him as possible, there was also a strategy behind why they were keeping Sean and trying to just continue to question him. And that really was because they were trying to stall the situation. Police were trying to ask Sean as much information as they could because they wanted to prolong the interview in hopes that the DNA sample and the DNA swab that Sean submitted, those results would come back while he was still at the station and they could arrest him right then and there. Police really didn't want to have to get into a situation where they sent Sean home. But ultimately, after several hours, Sean was getting very irritable and he was getting frustrated, and he ultimately asked to be taken home. Now, police had no physical evidence against Sean at this point because, like I said, that DNA swab had not come back yet, and police could not hold Sean just based off of circumstantial evidence, so they had to drive him home. Now, police were a tad concerned, not knowing if Sean was going to try and leave town or run away. So they did have several police cars surveillancing his house right after they dropped him off. So they dropped him off, and then several police were sitting in their vehicles outside of the home. And then at about 1 a.m., police received the phone call that said that Sean Gillis's DNA swab was a positive match to the DNA that was found on the prior three victims. And this was the physical evidence that police needed in order to go ahead and make an arrest. So right after they got this phone call on the early morning hours of April 29th, 2004, police moved into Sean's home. Now, Sean was at home with his live-in girlfriend at the time, whose name was Terry. And according to Terry, she claimed that her and Sean were just about to go to bed. They were in their room when all of a sudden, five police officers slammed the door down and busted into the bedroom. Once the officers ran in, Sean was arrested right then and there, and Terry claimed that she kept on repeating over and over again, "What's going on? What's happening?" She had no idea about anything. And according to her, Sean just looked at her and said, quote, "Sorry, honey bunny." Now, of course, that was not an answer to what was really going on. So she kept repeating, "What's going on? What's going on?" And finally, a police officer looked at her and said, quote, "You didn't know? You're living with a serial killer," end quote. You guys, I have said it once and I will say it again. 2024 is the year of health for me, and that includes making sure I stay hydrated. So, whether you hydrate to live, or if you live to hydrate, Liquid IV quenches your thirst faster than water alone with 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients for everyday wellness, all in one single sugar-free stick. Sometimes drinking regular water over and over again, it just gets to be boring, but Liquid IV makes staying hydrated a more fun and enjoyable experience. Personally, for me, I look forward to drinking my favorite flavor, which is green grape, by the way, every single day, because not only is the flavor amazing, but it does the perfect job of quenching my thirst with the crisp taste. So whether I take Liquid IV after a long night out or after my workout, I'm certain that I will always feel hydrated and satisfied. With Liquid IV, there are no artificial sweeteners and there is zero sugar, which is really important for me. It's non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy, and one stick plus 16 ounces of water hydrates you better than just water alone. So however you hydrate, grab your Liquid IV Hydration Multiplier sugar-free in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 20% off your first order when you go to liquidiv.com and use code KILLER at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code KILLER at liquidiv.com. So with this all being said, you might be sitting here wondering, who is Sean Vincent Gillis? Well, Sean Gillis was born on June 24th, 1962 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, to his parents, Yvonne and Norman Gillis. Sean was raised primarily by his mother and his grandparents after his dad abandoned him right after he was born. Yvonne worked at a local television station, and while money was certainly tight sometimes, the love for Sean from his mother and his grandparents was very much overflowing. For all things considered, Sean seemed to grow up in a very normal lifestyle. He wasn't popular in school by any means, but he did have friends who would come over to his house. They would sit around and talk about things like Star Trek or listen to music and talk about girls. After graduating from high school, Sean got a job at a convenience store. However, this did not last long after he was let go from spending too much time looking at pornographic websites on the company's computers. Now, Yvonne ended up moving from Baton Rouge to Atlanta in 1992 and asked Sean if he wanted to go with her. However, he declined. Now, even so, Yvonne actually continued paying the mortgage for the house that Sean and her had been living in so that he would have somewhere to stay and he would have a home and he could live there. Now, this was really the first time that Sean had ever been on his own, and he was about 30 years old at this point. Now, according to the neighbors, Sean was very odd. He was oftentimes seen howling outside in his yard and yelling at the sky. Oftentimes he was seen cursing his mom for leaving. He was the neighbor that was seen looking through the windows and peeping in while there were women inside. All in all, the neighbors just described him as someone who was very, very creepy. Now, Terry and Sean ended up meeting in 1994 through a mutual friend, and the two hit it off very quickly. Terry even helped Sean get a job at the convenience store that she was working at. And while they did have a very loving relationship, there were some things that Terry did not love. She didn't love that Sean was a heavy drinker, and she was also very confused that Sean never really had any desire to have sex with her. However, she chalked it up to his pornographic addiction and that being the cause of it. Now, what Terry also did not know is that the same year that she met Sean was the same year that he committed his first murder. Sean committed his first known murder on a woman named Anne Bryan on March 20th, 1994. Anne was 81 years old and was living in an assisted living facility across the street from the convenience store that Sean was working at. Anne would often leave her apartment door unlocked because she had nurses coming in and checking on her in the morning, and she didn't want to have to get out of bed to let the nurses in, so she would leave her door unlocked. However, sadly, on March 20th, 1994, at around 3 a.m., Sean broke into Anne's apartment and stabbed her to death. Sean struck her 47 times, almost decapitating her completely and disemboweling her. Now, even though the murder was a major shock and tragedy to the community, the murder case eventually went cold and Sean did not get caught. So now let's circle back to Sean's arrest. He gets arrested and he gets taken back to the police station, and he is being charged with the three murders of Donna, Johnny May, and Catherine Hall. Now, when asked why he did it, when police asked Sean why he did it, he looked at police and said, quote unquote, does the word monster come to mind? Sean is now telling police about this monster and then asks police if they want to see what the monster is and what the monster does. And police really don't feed into this with Sean. They kind of redirect the conversation because at this point, they don't know if Sean's just doing this for attention or if he's trying to stray off from the real task at hand here. They don't really know what is going on. So they try and redirect the conversation and ask Sean why he was targeting these women. Now, when asked this, Sean claims that women need to be more on guard. They need to be more aware of their surroundings, and had this been the case, then the women that he killed may not have been a target. He talked about how a lot of his victims had a high-risk lifestyle, but not all of them did. He mainly just emphasized that women are just not aware of their surroundings, and he was showing them how easily they could be targeted. The way that Sean was speaking, it was almost as if he was trying to say that he was teaching these women a lesson to be more aware. So then police asked Sean about Catherine Hall's murder. They really wanted him to walk them through that. Now, initially, Sean told police that he really just wanted to see, quote unquote, what Catherine's butt looked like along with her femur, end quote. He also claimed that while he was driving down River Road, ultimately to bring Catherine to where her body would later be discovered, he claimed that Catherine was, quote unquote, not a passenger by that point, insinuating that she had already been murdered. Now, when it came to Donna, police asked Sean to walk them through Donna's murder. And according to Sean, he claimed that Donna was incredibly intoxicated when he picked her up, and then he drove her out to her burial site. He dropped her out of the car and he drove home. As he's talking through all of these murders, the nonchalantness and the casualness of the way that he is reflecting on all of these murders is truly incredibly eerie. Now, during this interview, Sean dropped a bomb on police, and he claimed that not only was he responsible for the three murders of Donna, Johnny May, and Catherine, but he claimed that he had murdered at least seven women in total, and that he said by the seventh one, he stopped keeping count. He did give some names to the other victims. Those victims would be 52-year-old Hardy Schmidt, 36-year-old Joyce Williams, 52-year-old Lillian Robinson, and 38-year-old Marilyn Nevels. Now, the Hardy Schmidt case was actually one that was very high profile, and as I mentioned to you guys earlier, that Sean had been talking about how he had been targeting high-risk lifestyle women because he wanted to basically teach them a lesson to be more aware of their surroundings. The Hardy Schmidt case was very different. Hardy Schmidt came from a very well-off family. Her dad was actually a judge, and she ended up marrying an attorney. Sean claimed that on May 30th, 1999, he saw Hardy jogging one day. He said that it was not the first time that he had seen her, and that one could argue that he was stalking her. Sean claimed that by May 30th, he had known that Hardy was going to come out jogging at a specific time, so he parked his car and waited for her. And Sean said that just like clockwork, and as he had predicted, Hardy shortly came afterwards jogging, and he started his car and began following after her. Sean claimed that he ended up pulling up behind her and ran his car into the back of her. He claimed that she flipped over and Sean came out of his car. He claimed that Hardy was worried about her back, and that is when Sean looked at her and said, quote, lady, your back is the least of your problems right now, end quote. Police then asked Sean why he had this obsession with cutting and carving his victims. They wanted to know where this desire came from. And that is when Sean claimed that it really just started in his early to mid-20s. And throughout the entirety of multiple interviews with police, Sean is seen laughing and joking about his murders. Like I mentioned earlier, he had this nonchalantness and casualness about the way that he talked about his victims. He claimed that he raped many, if not all of the women that he killed after he murdered them. He also claimed that he masturbated with the severed parts of his victims. At one point, he used a cookie jar analogy and claimed that when you see a cookie jar and you want it, but you know you can't have it, and once you put your hand in the cookie jar and you taste a cookie, you know what a cookie tastes like, and you're gonna want that over and over again. So he compared a cookie jar to the tragic and horrific murders of multiple women where he dismembered them and raped them. Now, police did search through Sean's home, and that is when they found 45 images on his computer of Donna Johnston's mutilated body. And those 45 were all of just Donna. Now, there were also many other photos of his other victims. And through all of this, it was discovered that in total, Sean had murdered 8 women and had kept their body parts as souvenirs. Sean stood trial on July 21st, 2008 and was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Now, the reason he got life instead of the death penalty was because the jury actually came to a deadlock when it came to the death penalty, so he was just sentenced to life in prison instead. He is currently 61 years old and is being held at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, and that, you guys, is the case of Sean Vincent Gillis. I'm really curious to hear what you guys have to say about this case. I am very interested to know all of your thoughts about it, so please let me know in the comments below. But with that being said, you guys, that's going to be all for me today. Thank you guys so much for tuning in to another episode of Killer Instinct. Again, if you're new here, hi, my name is Savannah. I'm your host of Killer Instinct. Make sure you go ahead and hit the subscribe button. That way you never miss an episode. We post weekly here on the podcast every single Wednesday. You're not going to want to miss it. I'll be back next week with a brand new one for you guys, and until then, stay safe. Bye, guys.